This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
Uber wants to beat Amazon of retail, of e-commerce.
The Disney Plus service might actually end up benefiting Netflix.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
Capital return is the key story for the U.S. banks.
The telcos naturally are moving into content distribution. I think it's a good move.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we will dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets. Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries that our analysts cover all around the world. And today, we're going to look at a deal between Concho and Conoco. I mean, it's me. I can do oil all day if I want, right? We're going to get some reaction to that, plus why plant-based meat interest at restaurants has waned during the pandemic. But first, it is time for Buy Now, Pay Later. We're talking about the holiday shopping season. It's here. Don't get scared. For more, we want to welcome Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industry Analyst Poonam Goyal. Poonam, it's really hard to feel like the holidays. How are they shaping up this year versus every other year?
It is hard, and it's coming early, right, like every year. But the estimates are for a low single-digit gain this year over last year, with the driving force really being digital, where sales could grow anywhere between 25 to 35% based on delayed estimates. And we at BI think that number is probably conservative and could be even higher.
So I guess let's break it down a couple things. I mean, how are companies planning for the e-commerce drive? And how are they then thinking about retail foot traffic, particularly when there's the Black Friday scenario where, you know, it used to be like a 48, 72-hour event, et cetera?
Yeah, it's going to be a different holiday. I don't think anyone would have ever envisioned that this could be possible, but most of the efforts are shifting digitally given the social distance mandate still in place and the capacity limits in store. So as retailers gear up for the peak Black Friday weekend, what we're going to see is really the deals move more and largely online. So if you think about last year, holiday kicked off, or the peak Black Friday kicked off really on Thursday, Thanksgiving Day, when stores did open, many stores did open. This year, stores are not opening on Thanksgiving Day. In fact, on Friday, some retailers have already said that they're only going to allow 20% capacity to last year. So if you just think about that, you know, it's probably likely that shoppers will prefer to shop online instead of waiting on lines to just be let in. And the deals could stretch longer, where you saw deals kind of end at 11, 12, or 1 in the afternoon. They could extend all day, given the limits that they have for shoppers to enter the stores.
And does that lead to the whole buy now, pay later? Because you'll have a better shot at doing that online than you would in a store. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I mean, buy now, pay later is really, as if you think about the consumer and the consumer spending environment today, unemployment rate is very high, and consumers may still be strapped for cash, especially if there's no stimulus introduced in the fall. So when you think about that, buy now, pay later has been a new phenomenon that really, you know, has been embraced by retailers more recently, and especially in 2020, which allows the shoppers, if you go into, for example, an American Eagle store, you can go ahead and shop and take the merchandise home with you, but pay for it in equal installments over time without paying any interest.
So how is that? How is that
option?
How is that? What?
Yeah.
How is that possible? I always thought they were like a layaway. Like, layaway has been there for a while, like at a TJ Maxx, but I thought you paid interest on that.
Well, layaway is very different, right? Layaway is you buy the product. So layaway was a common method used by cash-strapped shoppers that wanted the product but then would go later to pick it up. So you never took possession of the product. This is very different, where you're taking possession of the product first and paying for it later, where a layaway, you pay for it in installments, and then you pick it up at the end of your final installment. So a very different phenomena, and it's attracting a lot of people to it. And for retailers, you know, you probably wonder, why would retailers do this, right? Why are they giving the product without getting paid for it up front? And I'd say, you know, the answer to that is really inventory. So if you think about a retailer, the quicker that they can sell the inventory, the better price they can get for it. The faster they can turn inventory, the better their margin is. So it's a win-win situation for the consumer and the retailer.
So that's a great point. Talk me through inventory then. Like, I mean, for anecdotally, let's talk about Zara for a second, because there's like no inventory. Like, they seem to have managed it so well that there's just no sales. That's a very different story than a place that's going to say, look at buy now, pay later, because they really want to get rid of their stuff.
Well, it's not even really getting rid of your stuff. It's turning your stuff faster. So right now in retail, because retailers have cut back inventory so much in the spring, they're having to chase it, especially where it's selling. But if you think about just how the goods flow into store, right? So in a retail cycle, as soon as you bring the inventory in, it's at full price. 2-3 weeks later, it gets marked down 20%. Then 5 weeks later, 30%, 40%, 70%, 90%, right? So the sooner that you can sell the product, the better margin you'll get. So in this phenomenon for buy now, pay later, if a customer walks through the door and let's say they have $50 on them, they bought a shirt or a sweater, and they really liked this other piece that they wanted to buy, but they didn't have enough money for it, so they decided to come back later. If you have the buy now, pay later card, you can actually buy it and pay for it later. And now the retailer was able to sell that inventory faster, which likely would have higher margins than if they let it sit in the store to wait for the next customer to come in.
Oh, that's smart. I guess, is there also the thing where if they do buy now, pay later, do they come back into the store more? Is there also that add-on, or it's purely just they don't have to discount as much?
Well, there's a few different things that really work for the retailer here. One is the inventory turns are faster. Two, they get to sell it at a higher price earlier. And three, they get to build a bigger basket. And then four, I would say, is because you have this option, you're likely to shop with that retailer more, knowing that you can stretch what you have today further and buy more with it. So really, it's great for the retailer because they can drive a higher basket. They can drive higher conversion.
All right, good to catch up. Bloomberg Senior Industry Analyst Poonam Goyal, thank you very much. You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on some 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BIGO on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele, and it's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, now time to look at that big deal this week between ConocoPhillips and Concho. Here to walk us through it all, we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industry Analyst Fernando Valle. So, Fernando, you were the first person that I called when I was going to be interviewing the Conoco CEO. Nuts and bolts, what did Conoco get out of this?
Hi, Alex. Yeah, they got free cash flow and they got inventory for at least a decade. Concho has a really extensive Permian position. That was a gaping hole in Conoco's portfolio. They had the core of the core in the Bakken. They had the core of the core in the Eagle Ford. But in the Permian, they really had a small position in the Delaware Basin. Concho fills that gap. And after Conoco abandoned deep water in 2016, it was really one of the only places that they could go.
Well, but that's the thing, is that I feel like every time I talk to Ryan Lance, it would be, yeah, not so much with the Permian. You know, you got the high decline rates. It's going to be expensive to buy in. So, I mean, they're considered in some ways like the non-Permian play. So that kind of surprised people.
Well, I think he was just being coy with his position so that he didn't inflate the price any further. But when you look at the acreage price that he paid for Concho, it's much lower than what we saw acreage selling in 2017 and 2018. So he bid his time and he bought at a much lower price because of the oil price crash. And because, as very well reported, Team Leach said on the conference call, you know, with 40% declines, it's hard to pay the dividends that investors want out of shale plays. So Concho was really seeing a treadmill that they couldn't keep going at. Mm. And combining with Conoco made sense, and Conoco just waited till a good time to make an acquisition, and they really bought one of the premier assets in the Permian.
Yeah, there's all these conflicting signals, and from analysts that I've been chatting with about why Concho did it. Like, they were definitely the first company that anyone asked about when it came to M&A, who's going to buy Concho, because they are so good. But then there's also, like, seriously, like 15% premium from October 13th price? Like, did anyone care about getting a higher price?
Well, you know, they also merged with potentially the better major in shale. You know, Conoco has been really disciplined with their capital ever since they cut their dividend early on in the oil price crash. And again, 2016, they've been reducing their leverage very aggressively. And when you look at the culture on how to run shale, they're probably the most aligned. And it puts a lot of pressure on others now because you took out both an acquisition target in Concho and also an acquirer out of the table. And now any of the other equities that are left aren't nearly as attractive as Conoco was because of their free cash flow generation, because they could, they have a strong balance sheet and the size to acquire pretty much anyone beneath them in scope.
So I guess then it becomes, what kind of company is Concho? Like, I get that they developed they have now the premier asset. Concho got the premier buyer. I get that. There was a story that I was talking to an analyst from one of the main shops that said, look, I mean, Conoco made a name for itself by not being in the Permian, right? So they were differentiated. They were in Alaska, Eagle Ford, they're overseas, and now they have this really great position, but so do a lot of other companies. So now they're undifferentiated. Does Conoco care about that, or is the goal just to like have this cash cow at some point that they can just use that money to develop longer term assets?
Well, I think I'll disagree with that, analyst. I think if you ask Ryan, the differentiation in Conoco has been they've developed shale slowly. They weren't growing at 100% per annum, or even 40-50% per annum. They grew their Eagle Ford shale for free cash flow. The beginning, and if you look at a map of the wells drilled on their locations, their neighbors over drilled their acreage a lot, while Conoco still has a lot of dry powder in the basin. That's why they can still grow even at low rates in Eagle Ford, which for the most part is a very mature basin. They preserve value at a time when everyone is competing for pipes, everyone is competing for equipment. They're doing the same now in the Permian. They bought at a much lower entry point. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just over $10,000 an acre, where it traded as high as $40,000 an acre. And the returns, which is really what this business is about, that is your entry cost. Similar to stock investing, if you buy something at an expensive price, you're always going to have a much higher hurdle rate to make a positive return. So Conoco bought at a low cost. They were disciplined about it. And now I don't think it matters where that oil comes from. It matters at what cost. And they've made sure that their entry point is low enough where they can make a superior return on capital versus some of their peers.
How do you expect them to develop it? Like, how much money to put in versus saving at some point for the dividend, buyback, et cetera?
Yeah, I think the idea is to, and it's kind of spreading through the E&P space, is to spend about 70% of your operating cash flow on CapEx. And again, to point to Conoco's discipline over the years, when you look at their original plan for 2020, they were spending about the same $6.5 billion in CapEx as EOG, a company that produces 40% less oil than Conoco. So I think they will be much more measured than peers. And part of what they've done with Concho is that because they acquired low-cost resources, they're able to delay a lot of their frontier exploration. That's a big part of about half of the $500 million in annual synergies that they were expecting, because they have so a decade of resources ahead of them. They can delay that. And so they'll probably, in this early years, be very measured and slow. Mm-hmm. You know, they're running very few rigs in the Eagle Ford and Bakken. They'll probably won't pick up significant amounts versus what Concho was running in their acreage. Mm-hmm. And then wait until this dearth of investments that we're seeing in 2020 contributes to the rebalancing and eventually an increase in oil prices in the next 2 to 3 years to pick up activity. And at that point, some of their peers may not no longer be able to attract the same amount of capital, and the competition for equipment, for pipelines, et cetera, will be much lower, and they can reap a much higher return. I think shale can make it, and the issue that we're seeing since 2016 is that the capital structure was built for a higher oil price, and that's what we're going through, the painful reorganization of the shale industry around a lower for longer, potentially forever, oil price scenario. So we need to restructure that. But the resource itself is good. The issue from 2016 is that we're no longer seeing the massive improvements in efficiency, and the recovery factors may be lower than we had anticipated and hoped for in 2016, 2017.
I love it. Thank you so much. Really interesting. So much speculation on who's next, etc. All right, Fernando Valle, a Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst. He's literally on my speed dial. Thank you very much. All right, coming up on the program, it's a look at why GE's risk is high and not improving. You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We will be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries. Our next guest has a how-to guide for GE to improve its risk. For more on what this means, we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence senior credit analyst Joel Levington. A how-to guide? That's pretty cool.
Well, we try, Alex. We try.
All right. What is it? What's in it?
Sure. Well, you know, the basic issue with General Electric is that a combination of weakness in the power markets as well as aerospace has left it really well over leveraged for its ratings and for its financial position. So the game becomes how do they do that, right? How do they fix that problem and help all stakeholders? So our analysis basically boils down to a couple of things. When we evaluate how raters rate, a huge amount of their rating boils down to the company's size. In fact, its size is viewed as AAA, whereas things that you and I might think a bondholder might care about, things like profitability, cash flow, and leverage, are all junk. So they can't essentially break up the company as many pundits want them to. So that's one factor, is that we can't break it up. But what we can do is figure out how to reduce debt without a full breakup of the company. Our analysis suggests that they need to reduce debt by at least $10 billion by the end of next year to avoid a rating cut, and by $15 to $20 billion for them to meet their own personal target of net debt leverage of 2.5 times. So that's the story. That's the starting point. How they do that, to us, it seems like they should follow the path that Siemens took with their business, which would be to spin off 15 to 20% of their healthcare business.
Ooh, isn't that their cash cow, though?
It is their cash cow, and it's a great business. We estimate that revenue should be about $17.7 billion next year with about $3.6 billion of EBITDA. So the game would really be a financial engineering exercise to create a new balance sheet for the healthcare company, leverage it like an investment-grade company, and then use the proceeds of that to either reduce debt at the parent company and also take some of the pension liabilities off of GE. As it turns out, GE has the largest underfunded pension in the S&P 500, which is another issue that creditors hold against them in their readings.
Let me ask the silly question. This is really silly, by the way. Do they have to reduce their default risk in that if they just muddle along like this, is that okay?
Well, they don't have to reduce their default risk. I think the two things that I would keep in mind is that the stock has a lot of fear factor baked into it. In other words, it would help their stock out to reduce the risk. And so it's one case where reducing leverage or financial risk actually is a win for everybody, whether it's a shareholder or a bondholder. So that's one thing. The other thing I would say is that if you look at CEO and Chairman Larry Culp's history, he has run businesses with leverage of about 1.5 times on a gross basis. We estimate that GE might be closer to 5 times leverage at year end. And so I think if I consider his, you know, through his lens, he would rather have a lower risk business than not. Mm-hmm. In fact, he took steps earlier this year by selling off the biopharmaceutical business to Danaher for $21 billion and used all that for net debt reduction.
Yeah, it helped that he came from there, that whole jam. But I mean, I guess also I have to wonder, I can see why debt holders of GE would like it, but like, do stakeholders, shareholders, like, is this the kind of company that they want to own? Because this would be a dramatically different GE, but this would be a totally, I mean, would it even be a cyclical company anymore, really? It's not a conglomerate.
Yeah, really, to me, it's almost more of a diversified machinery company right now between its power business aerospace and its healthcare business. And I think longer term, it doesn't necessarily need to be all under one umbrella. But to get to that place where they could divest businesses, a few things have to happen. The first thing is that they have to de-risk the balance sheet. And so a healthcare partial IPO, to me, is the easiest and most effective road of getting that. And that's mainly because if you look at healthcare peers, they trade at something like a 18 times EV to EBITDA multiple, so very high market multiples, which not only gives them an equity to go and make acquisitions and be competitive from a business standpoint, but also allows GE to lop off some of the debt onto that business because it can handle it. That would be the first step. The second step, obviously, is you need to see recovery in aerospace. And, you know, who knows when business and leisure travel are going to return. And my guess is that they will return at different growth rates with leisure coming first. And so you're going to need some of that to get the aerospace business back together. And the third thing is you need to see cost reductions take place.
Okay, thank you so much, Joel Levington, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Credit Analyst. Coming up on the program, plant-based meat. Anyone? Why consumer demand for faux meat is waning during the pandemic. You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the Terminal. I'm Alex Steele. It is 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Apparently, consumers are not paying as much attention to faux meats as they used to. To help us understand why consumer interest has declined during the pandemic, we are pleased to welcome Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Michael Hale. And Michael, I feel like I could come up with a list of like 17 different reasons why this would be the case, but tell me yours.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the primary reason was that, you know, through the pandemic and the lockdowns and the social distancing, you know, people were stressed out and they just tend to look for comfort foods, look for things that weren't necessarily very healthy. I think a lot of diets and healthy eating went by the wayside and people were opting for more indulgent, you know, things that were readily recognizable. A lot of the restaurant chains in the United States actually pared down their menus because a lot of the menu items on the fringes, you know, people just weren't ordering. People were being less adventurous and just kind of sticking with it to what they know.
So I guess my question, as we reopen and get back to whatever normal this is that changing, or do you think that this is sort of a rotation back to old school, you know, steak?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I think there was some fatigue going on in the QSR names, right? And I think there's a few reasons for that. But Burger King's probably the best example to use. They're the largest chain here in the U.S. that were selling, you know, plant-based meat. And excuse me, they sales started to wane late last year. Early this year, they actually included the item, which typically had a price tag of a dollar more than the regular Whopper. The Impossible Whopper was added to some of the value meals, and so to us, it was a clear sign that interest had been waning. And you know, we got some data from a AI and machine learning company that kind of corroborated this, that showing that interest on social media had definitely waned in the first quarter leading into the pandemic. And then we think there's a few things going on there. I think number one, the quick service restaurant industry and their lower and middle income consumers are probably not the best target market for this item. So 2019, Burger King and Del Taco and some chains had a little bit of success because people were kind of going out there and trying it for the first time. But I think that was more, there was some novelty to it, right? So people wanted to try it. They wanted to tell their friends they tried it. They wanted to give it a shot, but they didn't necessarily like it more than their normal burgers. And what we've found, we've seen surveys from Revenue Management Solutions that said, you know, only 25% or so of the U.S. population are willing to pay more for plant-based meat, and more than 50% say it's too expensive right now. So I think part of the reason is it's just kind of probably not the best place to sell it in a fast food restaurant.
Well, I also wonder, too, like how many people actually go buy it and make it at home versus they only will eat it in a restaurant, in which case the pandemic just shut that down completely.
Yeah, so it's been interesting with Beyond Meat and Impossible. Typically, the food companies, you know, they sell first into retail and then go to the restaurants after. They've kind of flipped it on their heads, and they kind of got a lot of free publicity from the restaurant chains selling this, and actually got a lot of U.S. customers to try it. And then now, through the pandemic, as you know, everybody's shopping in the grocery stores, sales are actually spiking at retail, at the grocery stores. So we're seeing a big shift, a lot less people ordering it at restaurants, especially fast food restaurants, and a lot more people going to their local Whole Foods or Kroger and picking up some patties to make themselves.
So what do we learn about this? As, you know, betting on these kind of companies was like all the rage, Do we learn that we need to have a broader basket of these kind of stocks that will incorporate, you know, makers of Cheetos or what?
Yeah, well, listen, indulgence always sells. I mean, so yeah, Cheetos, people aren't going to stop buying Cheetos anytime soon, especially hot Cheetos. I love them. But, you know, I think generally, you know, it is good to have a wide you know, a wide view. People aren't, you know, not everyone in the United States is eating like they are in California or New York, right? Like, not everyone is eating very healthy diets. And a lot of places in America, people associate health food with things that taste bad, right? So there's plenty of room. The American, you know, the American eater likes a broad spectrum of options, right? And so while there's definitely, you know, healthier foods, which is one of the issues with plant-based meat, right? Is like a lot of people don't necessarily think it is actually better for you.
Is it, though? I mean, is it? Is it?
I don't know. I mean,
you're like, I don't. Your guess goes mine.
Like canola oil, yeah, it's kind of above my pay grade. But, I mean, listen, one's made in a lab. Another one has a lot of canola oil in it. So if you look at Beyond and Impossible, there's a lot of people out there that say, yeah, you know what, I'd prefer pastured chicken or grass-fed beef, because it's natural and our bodies, you know, the human body is accustomed to it, right? People have been eating that stuff for thousands of years. So, you know, that's part of the issue with some of these plant-based meats as well. You know, I definitely speak to vegetarians that say, like, you know, this stuff was cool and I tried it and it's pretty good, but I actually prefer a black bean burger,
mm-hmm.
right?
True.
So it's kind of interesting, but there's definitely room for all sorts of food companies to do well here in the United States, and indulgence. You know, indulgence, like fast food companies, the stuff they sell, there's always a place for that in people's diets. You know, people aren't going to shy away from it. And like you said, especially when it's, people are under stress like they were in the pandemic.
I know. I ate like way too much ice cream during the pandemic. All right. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much, Michael. Good to chat. Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industry Analyst Michael Halen. All right. Time to switch gears to 5G. Sort of a pun there. Our next guest writes that Apple's first 5G iPhone may drive upgrade volumes for Europe's mobile carriers. Joining us now with all the details is Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industry Analyst Matthew Bloxham. Okay, first off, do 5G phones work everywhere? I don't understand it yet.
Yeah, not really. I mean, you know, the coverage of 5G is still pretty patchy, even in the best countries. There's actually some interesting data that was published recently by a company called OpenSignal, who basically kind of test real-life experiences of people on mobile networks. And actually what they found is that, like in Europe, people with 5G phones are only getting a signal about 3-4% of the time, probably in the best markets, places like Saudi Arabia and Korea, where 5G is a bit more developed, but still only kind of, you know, 20-30% of the time that you're actually getting the signal. So, you know, these operators are still kind of a fairly early stage of making 5G networks available, even if you've got the device.
So then I guess what comes first? Like, did Apple need to make the 5G iPhone to get people to buy them so then people go make all those pipes that you need and infrastructure? Or does it need to go the opposite? And in which case, why would I buy a 5G iPhone?
Yeah, it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, isn't it? I mean, obviously, Samsung's been out there and a few other vendors, including Huawei, with 5G phones for about a year now. So they kind of got the ball rolling a bit. But, you know, certainly in countries like or the UK or Europe as a whole, and certainly the US, you know, where Apple is a really big part of the overall smartphone market, for example, in Europe. Apple is probably 25 to 30% of all smartphones, so it's a really big deal. So you know, I think the operators need to get going. People like Samsung and Huawei have helped, but you know, really, until you get Apple on board, it's not really kind of big profile. And suddenly, that Apple launching, really pushing 5G, it becomes a much bigger thing with the kind of the popular mindset. Yeah, I think some people will still question whether, you know, should I get the 5G iPhone if there isn't that much 5G network available. But, you know, there's definitely a lot more to the iPhone 12 than just 5G. I mean, yeah, there's a huge, as I guess with every iPhone upgrade, there's a huge amount of features which comes with it. And we've seen that again with this one. So I think a lot of people are just going to upgrade to the iPhone 12 because it's the latest iPhone and it's got a better camera. The screen's meant to be stronger, you know, these other things, and then the 5G is just there as something extra in the background, which, you know, maybe over time they'll notice actually gives them some better speed performance on the networks.
Can you help me understand how hard it is to get 5G rocking and rolling? Like, what does it do?
I think it's a big investment, and so from a network operator perspective, you know, it's billions of dollars of network that they've got to roll out. You know, the sector's not doing too badly, but, you know, margins are under pressure, sales aren't growing. They're all quite leveraged in Europe, so they're having to be careful with how they spend the money, and they want to make sure they've got the best out of the 4G networks that they started building 10 years ago. And then you've had this added complication, which has definitely hit Europe, and I guess to some degree the US too, is that Huawei is now a no-go on the infrastructure side. So most of the operators in Europe had Huawei in their network plans for 5G, probably contributing maybe anywhere between 25% and 50% of the infrastructure, partly because it's cheaper and partly in some areas the Huawei technology is much better than you can get from Ericsson or Nokia. And now that, you know, in most European countries, you can't use Huawei anymore. They've had to go back to the drawing board in terms of their networks, sign new deals with Ericsson and Nokia, figure out a way to make that work from a numbers perspective. So I think that that kind of security concern and the Huawei bans has definitely maybe added a year or two at least to the pace at which you'll get these networks rolled out across Europe.
Really interesting point. I hadn't even really thought about that. Thank you so much, Matthew Bloxham, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industry Analyst. And that is this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele. It is 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
For those fortunate enough to help the person who has always been their hero, find the care guides you need to help at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.